This is the takeaway for Friday, January 20th, 2017.
From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
Says this country's 45th president, Donald J. Trump. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. He takes office amid serious questions about his vision of the U.S. role in the world. He enters the White House with low approval ratings, hovering around 40%, lingering scars from a deeply divisive election campaign. But as president, Mr. Trump told American workers and families, the cavalry is on the way, and a love of country will be our binding force.
A new national pride will stir our souls, lift our sights, and heal our divisions. It's time to remember that old wisdom our soldiers will never forget, that whether we are black or brown or white, we all bleed the same red blood of patriots.
Where do we stand? We're joined now by Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, who's on the line with us from the nation's capital. Todd, your thoughts?
Well, John, it was a brief speech, as you said, and I thought it was a speech that really straddled two big places for Donald Trump. A lot of the similar campaign rhetoric, as you said, there were one or two policy promises, but a real kind of reappeal, telling his supporters that he was putting Washington in their hands, saying they were no longer going to be forgotten. And then towards the end, some of the loftier, at times even Lincoln-esque language of a divided people, you know, living under the same sky with the same dreams, he said, even under the same God. This invokes Abraham Lincoln, who observed that both the North and the South prayed to the same God. He was Reagan-esque at other times when Donald Trump said that the United States would be a shining example to other nations that they could follow, that shining city on the hill that Ronald Reagan so famously invoked for the American people. And then at other times, really sort of seemed to be contrasting with President Obama and even other presidents who said before him to say that the time of Washington forgetting about the people was over, the time of Washington leaving cities to rot and factories to rust and jobs to go overseas and forgetting about the people, that was over, placing himself squarely in the ranks of his own supporters. And I just want to say, John, it's an important moment for any politician. Donald Trump, as you said, is now President Trump, the 45th president, and everything changes for Donald Trump now. The campaign is over. The president-elect phase is over. The decisions are his. The political ownership is his. The need to sway Congress is his. The low approval rating, frankly, is his. And the challenge of keeping members of Congress who worry about their own re-elections, their own political fortune, and their own ideologies is also his now. Everything changes from this moment.
As you say, Todd, the invocation, I mean, the mission of Donald Trump today was to reach out to those people who were his constituency, that middle class that has felt so neglected and forgotten by the Washington government. And he explicitly called for a transfer of power away from Washington, D.C., back to the people. He talked about gangs and drugs in American cities. He talked about a bolstering of the military to make it safer. But he also talked about a redirecting of wealth to rebuild America's infrastructure, very much in keeping with the themes that were powerful for the middle class during the campaign. Foreign thieves impoverish the American middle class, and that will change. It will be America first from now on, buy American, hire American. That's the theme. He did declare that he will eradicate Islamic radicalism from the earth, and he called for an end of American carnage, which I didn't quite understand, but certainly for what is normally a very positive moment. Inaugural speeches tend to be positive moments, forward-thinking moments. This contained a lot of negativity, a lot of sense that America is really in bad shape right now. Joining us now, Carolyn Ryan, senior editor for politics from our partner, The New York Times. Carolyn, what do you think of what's happened so far, what we've heard from Donald Trump, and what it says about the next 4 years?
So many things are striking to me about this speech. One, just to pick up on your point, there was a bellicosity about some of the language, the carnage, the other countries stealing our companies. and sort of there was almost sort of a warlike footing on this issue. The other thing that was quite striking to me, given that Donald Trump, his identity, his life has been fairly secular, I think the influence of the conservative movement and some of the pastors he's been surrounding himself with, the repeated invocations of God. The other thing that was quite dramatic to me was that there was very little reaching out to those who didn't vote for him, didn't support him. There was a lot of language that was essentially from his rallies, from his campaign. And there was his identity as a builder of things really came through, that was sort of the potent thread throughout, that he's calling on people to build a new America, and that seemed like the message. But there was no, for example, acknowledgement of Hillary Clinton. There was nothing deep said to people who didn't support him or are worried about the future of the country. And remember, that's a fairly significant number of people who are listening.
Well, for the people who are descending on Washington, even as we speak, to be a part of this Women's March tomorrow, there was no discussion of any of the gender issues that were so powerful during the campaign. But he did set up a kind of philosophical construct that the way to become a diverse and peaceful and not racially divided nation is for everyone to be a patriot, and that it is our patriotism that will bring us together. Glenn Coffey is a member of the Oklahoma State Senate from 1999 to 2010. He's now a lawyer at Glenn Coffey and Associates. Glenn, we're going to see you next week in Oklahoma as we spend some time in Oklahoma thinking about the inauguration and about the places where the middle class lives. What do you think about the address, and what do you think about some of the language that Donald Trump has used here?
Well, John, thanks for having me. And I think it was a fascinating speech. I agree with Todd's characterization. There were echoes of Lincoln's second inaugural. There was the Shining Hill reference to Reagan. But I also think there are references, and I understood he looked at this speech in preparation, to Nixon's Forgotten Man. I think he must see some parallels to the late 1960s when there was a very divided country and people who felt left behind. And those were certainly messages that Nixon early on embraced to try and bring the country together. I would different observation than the rest of you. I think while it was at a 30,000-foot level, while it was broad strokes and it was not specifically targeted to people who were fearful or people who were upset, you could make the argument it's American nationalism. But I think his goal was to say we're all Americans. And when he's talking about the child in Detroit and versus Nebraska, he talks about unity. They share the same breath of life. I think he was making the attempt to say that we have commonalities that we can embrace and we can come together. And, you know, he focused on some policy issues about radical Islamic terrorism, as he's always talked about, and infrastructure. But he said the phrase we all knew he would say, which was to make America great again, which, whether it's through strength or wealth or pride or safety, the issues that he tied to it, he was delivering the message that he wants all Americans to be proud of the country they live in.
Well, let's take a look at that, because that's really the challenge going forward. Is we look back on presidents who have been able to successfully evoke that patriotism as a common narrative. FDR in the middle of World War II, where America was facing a crisis, in the middle of the Depression, where America was facing a crisis. After 9/11, George W. Bush, when America was facing a crisis, this sense of unity naturally comes out of a sense of patriotism. But now, when people have a very different sense of the country, how challenging do you think, Carolyn Ryan, it will be for him to knit together these divisions that were so evident during the campaign?
Well, it's extremely daunting. I mean, one thing that was really striking to me talking to the reporters who are there is that they feel like, compared to past inaugurals, that there's much more kind of tension and less sort of a sense of celebration, national celebration, than you usually see on these occasions. And one thing that was quite vivid and kind of potent was the remarks offered by Chuck Schumer, which seemed to be his own definition of love of country and patriotism. And so for Donald Trump, I think, as you know, he was elected despite very high unfavorables, very broad unpopularity. This is a moment where it seems like perhaps he missed an opportunity to offer some more healing words, to ask for the help of people who didn't see eye to eye with him during the campaign. I think it's going to be a very daunting challenge. And I think those divisions, especially according to the reporters who are there, are more raw than they've seen in the past.
Todd Zwillick, thinking about those approval rating numbers, which are down, and looking out at the crowds, which are nothing like the crowds we saw in 2009 for Barack Obama, what do you think that says? I mean, the weather isn't cooperating here, but what do you think that says about the passion of this moment for most Americans?
I think it actually goes right along with some of the themes of what President Trump talked about in his address. He painted the picture, as he did throughout the campaign, of a country that he sees in dire straits, in a bleak condition. And as you said, John, he talked about the carnage of the country. Well, that type of narrative about where the country is at, you would expect not a great deal of enthusiasm for any leader, even a populist leader who managed to win an election despite being outperformed in the popular vote. So it's always been difficult to turn out throngs and throngs of supporters in a unified country against the backdrop of a negative vision of where the country is at.
Glenn Coffey, the language of carnage, American carnage, does that strike you as something that you're seeing in your own community that needs to end now? I mean, it may not be the exact right word, but was there a disconnect there at all in what Donald Trump was saying about the negative state of America right now?
I don't know that I share the view of carnage, but I think it speaks to the view of people that are upset, that they think for the first time in their lifetime the opportunities for their kids or their grandkids aren't what they experienced, that it didn't seem to be, the trajectory was going the wrong direction in a lot of the Midwest from our perspective. And I think he was capturing that with the images of the rusted, empty buildings and people's perspective that things have to change about creating jobs here at home, and that we have to have that focus.
Glenn, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. You guys have a great day.
Carolyn Ryan, I'll give you the final thoughts in thinking about what's happened today and what's likely to happen over the next 4 years.
Donald Trump's essence is that he's a salesman. He's easily hurt. His ego is easily bruised. His views are strikingly elastic, and he is enchanted by success, or at least the appearance of success. When he said today, "I will never let you down," it felt again like he was selling something to the American people. It's not that it's not sincere, but that's the essence of who he is. He can be seductive as a salesman, but he has some of the limitations of a salesman. And the question is whether he's going to be able to broaden his inner circle, broaden his aperture on the country and all the competing interests in Washington, and be a successful president. I don't think we should underestimate him, but we should also not underestimate the challenges he will face.
Carolyn Ryan is senior editor for politics with our partner, The New York Times. Carolyn, thanks to you. Thanks again to Glenn Coffey. And thanks to Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, who's been out there since the very early morning. Thanks, Todd.
Of course, John.
Thanks, John.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Here's a sample now of the passions and hopes of some Trump supporters on the National Mall who are looking forward to the first 100 days.
What do I want to see in the first 100 days?
I want to see how much he can do to undo the harm that has been done by his predecessor.
The promises that he made coming true and the wall going up.
Getting the wall built on the Mexican border.
Control the borders.
I want him to take care of Obamacare.
The repeal of Obamacare.
Oh. Obamacare.
Yes.
Kind of a return to a focus on the American people, in particular the American worker.
And him actually bringing back the economy a little bit.
Lower taxes.
Do something about ISIS.
Anything, man. Anything positive other than what we've been dealing with for the last 8-10 years. The last 2-3 presidents suck. So we need something different. That's it.
Reverse Definitely. Everything Obama did.
Yes. Immediately.
I'm not that optimistic.
Yeah, losing a lot of our civil liberties and privacy.
As long as we continue to fight the good fight, I think that's what we need to do to ensure that progress continues to be made.
That's a lot to ask in the first 100 days, but I want to see him prove to everybody that voted against him that he's here for them.
We have two more Trump supporters now watching events of the day unfolding from their homes. Cheryl St. Germain is a 61-year-old former restaurant owner in Marco Island, Florida. Hi, Cheryl.
Thank you.
Kevin Loney joins us also, who's a 61-year-old salesman from Manchester, New Hampshire. I don't know why we have a thing for 61-year-olds, but Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Hi, John. Thank you. It's a very nice to be here.
Very special demographic. Your thoughts about what happened today and that thought of the individual in Washington, D.C. who said it's really important for Donald Trump to be the president of all the people who didn't vote for him. How do you think he started today, Kevin?
I was surprised. I'm very pleased with him invoking, you know, the Lord and that we're one America. Because the people who didn't vote for him, and I've been trying, telling him, give him a chance, they're not going to be swayed by words. Probably why he didn't address it more in his speech. He'll show them. That's the only way. So I'm very excited, and I think we have to get around that.
Cheryl, you almost were one of the people who didn't vote for Donald Trump. How do you feel now?
Well, honestly, I have nothing but positive energy. We all know why the people were on the fence with this one, and it was challenging. But once the last debate came out, I was convinced, I was comfortable. I feel his strong determination to be successful. He's driven. He's a very powerful man, and he is going to do the best he can do. That I do believe.
All right. But he's now, you know, he's sucked into the bubble of Washington, D.C. He is in the tentacles of the Washington establishment. What's going to keep him from being taken over by that Washington establishment that has taken over so many other, high-minded presidents in the past? Cheryl?
Truthfully, no one has had a president like Donald Trump. He is unique in many ways, and I don't believe his challenges are many, but I don't believe that he is going to fall into that. He's too strong-willed and confident. He's got a lot going, and he's going to do well. I'm very positive and high energy about this.
Kevin, you're a salesman, right?
Yes, sir.
I mean, you got some of the same DNA that Donald Trump has, I suspect, right?
I do.
Yeah. Do you think he wants this job?
Yes. Some people say it might be rose-colored glasses, but when you think about assembling a team or, you know, selling a concept and, you know, righting the ship, yeah, it's probably the biggest ring he has ever reached for. You know, someone mentioned the corporations were nervous about him. Yes, because they've been making millions, and he talked to all of us who haven't. I mean, I can tell you since 2008, my income has dropped dramatically for a number of reasons. To have him surround himself with billionaires, I don't care. They're successful, and they know how to run things, get things done, accomplish it, and he knows we're watching. I saw one speech here in New Hampshire where he said, trust me, I want to turn it around. I wanted to make it about you, and that's what he started off saying today.
So to both of you, and I'm gonna push you pretty hard on this, Donald Trump says that patriotism is going to be our common ground. And when I was a little kid growing up, yeah, okay, you salute the flag. We're all Americans. That's the thing that unites us. But as I grew up and as I understood our history and as I understand the very different experiences of very different people, African Americans have a different view than white Americans, this idea of patriotism and whether the country's on your side or not varies radically from group to group. How can Donald Trump make this patriotic narrative that's going to bring everybody back into the tent? Because, boy, the election, the campaign, this was not a big tent campaign.
At the start of the election period, I listened to you faithfully, and I listened to WGBH in Boston because they lean a little to the left, and I'm definitely right. So I heard time and time again people saying why they feared this guy and why they feared us going more patriotism. And I did learn many, many things that I didn't see. One is sensitivity to some of these issues. But President Trump, he went out, reached out to Courier. He reached out to Ford. He's got some infrastructure. So all of a sudden now you're seeing a multifaceted plan, and he's got to continue that. He's got to call these people in and sit down and say, okay, no, we're not just going to throw you out. We're not just going to shut down Obamacare, but we want to do it right. So I think you'll see a multifaceted plan. I think you'll see many people going out. He sent his daughter to reach out to Al Gore. thought that was brilliant. He will do more of that, I promise you that. But he's going to hit the ground running, hopefully in a few hours.
I looked at the aerial shots there in Washington, and, you know, it's a pretty white crowd, Cheryl. Does that concern you at all?
Well, there's going to be a lot of problems with a lot of his social issues. My hope is that in time, when we see improvement, when things are going more positive, it's not going to happen overnight in a year. It might even be 3-4 years for a lot of his accomplishments. Let's not overanalyze everything that's just happening right now. Let's give him a chance and let's be on his side and be positive, and maybe he'll be the next Reagan. That's my hope.
Thanks to Cheryl St. Germain, a former restaurant owner in Marco Island, Florida, and Kevin Loney, a salesman from Manchester, New Hampshire.
The reason I'm not going is that I can't bring myself to justify morally or intellectually the immense power we are placing in that man's hands.
We should note 66 Democratic lawmakers were absent from this official transfer of power, part of a boycott initiated by Representative Luis Gutierrez of Illinois, speaking there, who took to the House floor last week to explain why he was skipping the swearing in.
I could not look at my wife, my daughters, or my grandson in the eye if I sat there and attended. Is it everything that the candidate said about the women, about the Latinos, the blacks, the Muslims, or any of the other things he said in those speeches and tweets, and that all of that is okay or erased from our collective memory?
Congressman and civil rights movement hero John Lewis of Georgia was also one of the boycotters today, as was Congresswoman Barbara Lee from California. What does a boycott accomplish? Congresswoman Lee, you'll recall, also boycotted the inauguration of George W. Bush.
I'm not looking at any boycott or staying away from inauguration as trying to accomplish anything. What I feel is important is to be a voice for millions of people who believe that they're being shut out or marginalized or denigrated. In 2001, of course, the Supreme Court appointed President Bush, and there were several of us who protested the seating of the or the certification of the Electoral College. To me, that was very undemocratic, and that was no reason to celebrate.
Donald Trump says he's the one speaking for the marginalized and the disenfranchised.
When he tells the African-American community, what do you have to lose, especially people who have been shut out of the right to vote, people who have had a history of systemic and institutional racism and bias and mass incarceration, there's a lot to lose because we've made significant progress over the years and we've got to keep moving forward. So I reject the fact that he's saying, what do we have to lose? We have a heck of a lot to lose. And I hope that this administration will understand that.
It's my impression that Donald Trump loves to convey a no more business as usual kind of attitude. He goes after someone like John McCain, a sacred cow on Capitol Hill in the GOP caucus. He's gone after John Lewis, certainly a very sacred member of the civil rights community. Do you think he views the whole Congressional Black Caucus as a sacred cow that he'd love to just bypass?
Well, it's hard to know what his views are, but I think his behavior and what he says and does is more important. And I just think that he has demonstrated that, at least up until this point, he has not assumed the role of the president-elect and has not been presidential in his statements and in his behavior.
But doesn't a boycott invite him to ignore you? I mean, he does carry vendettas.
It's not about vendettas. We have to step up and we have to really be true to our conscience. We have to be true to the millions of people who really believe that they have no voice. We have to wait and see. I intend to where we can work together to create jobs. I certainly hope they don't take away health care from millions of Americans, such as is being planned right now. I certainly hope that criminal justice reform is part of the agenda in a real way. So there are things that we have to work on together, but I have not seen any evidence of that yet. And so, you know, we can't think about this in political terms. We have to be a moral voice, a conscience, and we have to resist many of the policies that would damage and hurt so many Americans.
Representative Lee, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Representative Barbara Lee is a congresswoman from California representing Oakland and Berkeley and other parts of the East Bay.
Hi, everyone. This is Charlie Brotman. You're listening to The Takeaway.
The voice of Charlie Brotman has been the official announcer for the inauguration parades for 60 years. After holding the gig for 11 presidents, Brotman wasn't invited back for Donald Trump's festivities. We don't know exactly why. Brotman first landed the gig by chance. He'd been the announcer for the Washington Senators and announced Ike's ceremonial first pitch before a ballgame in 1956. And soon after, he got a call from the White House asking him to become the president's announcer for the 1957 inaugural parade. And that one-time gig turned into a lifelong adventure, he says.
Charlie Brotman? Yes. Well, I'm with the Kennedy Group. We have never been involved in a parade. We don't know how to do it, what to do. Would you come over to the White House and give us some pointers? And I did. And they said, of course, we want you to be the announcer. And I said, I would love to do it. I've never charged them one penny. I think it's such an honor. I would pay them to let me do it. What I did discover as we went along, the parade is an extension of the president's personality. As soon as Eisenhower went out of office, John F. Kennedy, it became high fashion. It snowed for like 3 days. They had 3,000 servicemen, 700 trucks, 100 snowplows, and army flamethrowers to melt the snow, melt the ice, and it was a four-hour parade, and I remember that the president and his brother, Robert, stayed the entire time. It was 4 hours. Mrs. Kennedy stayed 1 hour, too cold for her.
This is our summons to greatness. And I believe the American people are ready to answer this call.
Nixon, the weather was bitter cold. There was a threat of violence. It was a simple parade, took a couple hours, and he actually resigned 1 year later in 1974. Gerald Ford came into being, and he's the first president to serve without being chosen in a national election, and he had no inaugural parade. 1977, Jimmy Carter. He was the first one to basically say his inauguration was for the people.
I have no new dream to set forth today, but rather urge a fresh faith in the old dream.
And it was very cold. Band members had their lips freeze to the instrument's mouthpieces. It was really too cold to be in a parade.
Mr. President, my name is Charlie Brotman. I had the pleasure of introducing your dad, Godspeed.
President Bush, the younger one, and the parade stopped in front of me. I felt compelled to say something. And I said,
Mr. President, can we have your attention for one moment? Baseball fans throughout the greater Washington, D.C. area are looking forward to you throwing out the first ball at the Washington Nationals opening day game on April 14. Will you be there?
And he looked up and waved and considering it. About 20 seconds later, a Secret Service agent comes in. And he's very upset. He says, don't ever talk directly to the president. Don't ever ask him any questions. We don't want anybody to know where the president's going to be at any one time. Do you hear me? Yes, sir, I hear you. Okay, you're never going to do that again, are you? No, sir. So, and the media got a hold of that one and made a big to-do over it.
Your inaugural parade announcer has been Charlie Brotman.
Charlie Brotman was the inauguration parade announcer from 1957 to 2013. He will be covering Donald Trump's inaugural parade for NBC4, the NBC affiliate station in Washington, D.C.
We're bringing together all of these groups that there's been walls up between us.
There is a counter-message, a counter-gathering in Washington, D.C. this weekend that is an outgrowth of the nastiness of the 2016 campaign, where then-candidate, now-president Donald Trump was seen as tolerant of racism, demeaning sexualization of women, and hatred of immigrants. Hundreds of thousands are in Washington, D.C. for the Women's March on Washington, beginning with a rally near the U.S. Capitol. Organizers are expecting large turnouts in D.C. and at solidarity marches taking place across the globe.
A lot of communities, you know, just were marginalized during this past election, but also in our country's history. And so we're unifying together on Washington as one voice for, you know, the first time in a very long time. And especially we all have different issues, you know, we're marching for, which makes it really cool.
That's Breanne Butler, a global organizer of the Women's March on Washington. She joined me along with her co-organizer, Natasha Williams.
It's like not a march on Trump, right? It's a march on Washington. It's also a march for our U.S. senators, for our congressional body, for even local government, our governors, our state elected officials. It's just a march on the system itself, because the system itself is oppressive, right? And it oppresses women, it oppresses marginalized communities. And of course, the march was, I want to say, inspired by this recent election, inspired by a lot of the rhetoric by Trump and his administration, but it's not a march on Trump.
Do you think Washington gets how much transition that America seems to be in, and that this march will be a reminder that Washington is behind the curve rather than ahead of it?
That is the purpose of the march, is to remind people and to display how far behind the curve we are. So that is the hope.
This has been a total grassroots movement, and it's really been incredible watching these women step up. Like, I mean, Montana, their march is almost at 2,000 people at this point, which is huge. So not only the march is happening around the world, but then also the people that are coming to D.C., you know, they've worked really hard in getting their fundraising and getting people to sponsor them, asking their friends and family. And we have a mix of just everyday people that are passionate and want to see change. And they are coming, even if they're making minimum wage, they're scrapping together their dollars to be a part of history.
Is it a hard question for you to answer? Is Donald Trump a legitimate president, or your president in 2017?
So this question is always hard for me, because I'm always at the intersection of the system. To say that he's not my president to me is like anti-democracy, which I want to believe in democracy, like, with all of my heart. But, I mean, there's a lot of glaring flaws and discrepancies with his presidency, with his election. I'm thinking about John Lewis and, you know, that whole thing that's just totally blown up. And I don't know if it's difficult. It's just a constant internal battle. And that's just because of the intersection that I live in, wanting to, you know, be democratic, wanting to really respect our system and our government and having a love for it, but then also understanding a lot of the discrepancies.
Breanne?
I think the bottom line is I believe in America, and I believe in the people. And it's fighting for them, fighting for those rights, you know. And it's hard, because he's gone against a lot of that, even just with his nominee picks. As far as we've come as a country, I feel like we'd just be taking steps back, what we fought for so long as a woman, not to mention as a black woman or a Muslim woman or a Native American woman. It's very disturbing.
I mean, you said it's not an anti-Trump march, but what would be your hope for this message being a counter message to the inauguration?
Us coming together like this, I mean, that's powerful in itself. We still don't know exactly how many people are going to show up, but I think that even just having that human interaction, right now we live through our screens, right? And there's something about actually connecting with somebody and being in a place with hundreds of thousands of other people that feel the same way. There's power in that. And I think that people are going to be pumped up after this march. And if we can keep that momentum going and give them the tools and the resources, educate them in how they can get involved on a local level, because it happens from the ground up. If you can make a difference in your zip code, then yeah, those decisions can turn the country around. You know, we have three keywords: educate, organize, mobilize. And to be honest, we might be marching again, maybe sooner than we'd like.
Is that really the impetus from this election? So many people have said, you know, I'm sick of the federal government. Obviously, there's importance at the federal level. But do you think there's a renewed effort to focus on local politics?
Yes.
You run for office.
Yeah.
You're going to, do you plan to get involved?
You know, the Republican Party has always focused locally. That's been their strength.
And they've done a hell of a job.
And they've done an amazing job. And so I think for the Democratic Party, 100% is this renewed sense to really focus on local elections. So, yes, I agree. This election, this campaign has definitely inspired the Democratic Party to focus on local elections.
You know, for me, it was always really intimidating. You know, I felt like, oh, I don't know enough to speak up, so I just won't say anything, or you know, just blindly sharing a story without really reading it. But yeah,
well,
there's a lot to do.
I mean, lace up your shoes and run for something. That's what the president said in his farewell address.
Yes.
He wasn't talking about Republicans or Democrats. Whatever it is, do it.
Yeah, exactly. He said, get a clipboard, get some signatures.
Yeah. I hope anyway that this march encourages people to be like, you know what? I might not have known about things before. I might not have been there, but I'm here now and I'm willing to learn. And this is where the change is going to happen. Everyday people stepping up. We're seeing a wave of political activism we haven't seen since the 60s or 70s, and it is well overdue. But you know what? I think we're heading into a new era, and hopefully people do get involved, because I'm sorry, but sharing a status on Facebook isn't enough. And I think that we all saw this past election.
Breanne Butler, Natasha Williams, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So with no poet this time around, what would you recite at this inauguration?
This is Lynn Ray Pardo from Austin, Texas. And I am not a fundamentalist, but nothing short of Psalm 23, verse 4 will do. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. I won't be dismayed. I've got courage as my refuge.
Lynn Ray Pardo. All right. What poem or piece of literature fits this inauguration? In your view, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'll hear from an inaugural poet next. Stay with us. A tradition dating from 1961, and John F. Kennedy was absent at today's inauguration. I don't know if you missed it. It's a poetry reading. Robert Frost was the poet who read in 1961.
The land was ours before we were the land. She was our land more than 100 years before we were her people. She was ours in Massachusetts and Virginia, but we were England's, still colonials, possessing what we still were unpossessed by what we now no more possess.
At this poetry-free inauguration, we've asked Richard Blanco to supply some thoughtful verse for a time of historic change. He was the inaugural poet, you may remember, for Barack Obama's inauguration back in 2013.
Well, I think, of course, we come to poetry in times of great joy and in times of great confusion. And certainly the poem that I wrote for Barack Obama's inauguration, almost 4 years to the date, was a poem about getting closer to that, to fulfilling that dream, that hope of one people, right? But the poem still echoes the idea that we're not quite there yet, right? That we need to keep on doing this work. Today, I think the poetry that I see happening is, how are we looking at different questions, and how are we taking back democracy, and how are we realizing that we're more the same than we are unalike? And when did this happen? When did this sort of, how can poetry become a bridge of understanding, and how can poetry get us back to some other space, get us back to understand our shared humanity?
One Today was the poem you read in 2013, right?
Yes.
I wonder if you could read either some of those words and recall maybe some of the promises unkept in the 4 years since, or maybe some new words that you've been fiddling with.
Sure. Well, I think I'll read the last stanza of that poem, which sort of was setting the tone or the charge of where we perhaps were at that moment, a country perhaps on the edge of moving a needle in a positive direction, I think. And so it goes, we head home through the gloss of rain or weight of snow or the plum blush of dusk, but always, always home, always under one sky, our sky, and always one moon, like a silent drum tapping on every rooftop and every window of one country, all of us facing the stars and hope, a new constellation, waiting for us to map it, waiting for us to name it together.
It's nice.
You know, having experienced the inauguration almost 4 years ago, had a very good seat that year. You know what? There is just something amazing about that moment. I had never been to an inauguration before. And besides the politics or anything like that, there's just this incredible statement that moment makes. I always wondered, why do these hundreds of thousands, millions of people come to this lawn, to this mall, to sit here and do what? It's cold, it's rainy, like, and there's a power in that about bearing witness. The unsaid thing that's happening there, it's like it's bearing witness, and it's like to remind the elected president that you're up there because we're down here and we're watching you. You know, even if you are even if you voted for the president that was elected or not, there's just sort of an almost sort of sacred moment there that has nothing to do with politics or parties, and it's really about that essence of bearing witness and saying our democracy belongs to us. And we're here to remind you of that in some ways.
All right. So here we are. I'm going to give you a little assignment here, put you on the spot. Start us on this journey. Send us off, Richard Blanco.
Oh, boy. Well, let's go back to the theme we sort of started, which is we're watching. Let's keep watching. Let's keep on participating in our democracy as we should be, all of us. I think that's the one thing we can do. I think that's important for us to abide by the foundation of our democracy, that we all agreed to these rules, right? And I think if you lose that, if you lose that, then we've lost everything. Somebody asked me, am I hopeful? And I said, well, I'm hopeful in the system, not necessarily the president or the presidency, but I'm hopeful in the system, and I'm hopeful that the system is self-correcting. And as I look, now that I've had obviously several months or weeks since the election, you know, part of me is in awe and admiration that the United States, and maybe this can only happen in the United States, that the pendulum swing from President Obama's election to Trump's election, that somehow that could only happen in the United States. It's almost,
yeah, that is true.
It's almost worth a chuckle, but for like half a second, right? But the idea, there's something really interesting and oddly bizarre and beautiful about that, right? This is still one of the greatest experiments in human history. You know, the idea that people from all over the world can come together and somehow form a union that would be a utopia. And we're still working on it. I mean, one of the things that the inauguration experience taught me, and you read about this in history books, blah, 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 but it becomes so visceral at that inauguration, is that this is still a work in progress. And sometimes there's a chapter we don't like, or sometimes there's a weird chapter, or sometimes there's a chapter, but you need that chapter to write the next chapter. And I think that's very important. And I think that's the place we should be.
Do you have a poem for today?
Not necessarily. but, you know, last night I was thinking, of course, inaugural poets and stuff like that. And, of course, I thought back all the way to Frost, the very first inaugural poet at Kennedy's inauguration. And I thought it's a very popular poem, but I thought, I wonder what Frost would read at the inauguration if he were alive today. I thought this one was perfect. And it's a pretty popular poem. It's called Fire and Ice. And it's a really short poem. I don't know if you want me to read it. I thought it's where we're at today, you know, and it's a very ambiguous poem in the sense of what makes us survive, what destroys us, what are the worst and best things, and how, well, like Frost, everything, well, like poetry in general, it's like it's got layers and layers of meaning. So Fire and Ice by Robert Frost. Some say the world will end in fire. Some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. But if it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice.
God, that's so great. You launch us off into this journey over the next 4 years. We're watching you folks in Washington. We are valuing our democracy by our embrace of our fellow citizens and our impulse to make change around us. That's all we can do, right?
Yeah, and do it together.
Richard Blanco, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Richard Blanco was President Obama's inaugural poet in 2013. He's the author, most recently, of The Prince of Los Cocoyos, A Miami Childhood. Well, we've all got our work in this work in progress. We leave you with some of the final remarks from our new president, Donald J. Trump.
Together, we will make America strong again. We will make America wealthy again. We will make America proud again. We will make America safe again. And yes, together, we will make America great again. Thank you, God bless you, and God bless America.
Next week, we'll be broadcasting from KOSU in Stillwater, Oklahoma. We hope you'll join us for that. Thanks for being with us today for our coverage of the inauguration. Thanks to producer Oliver Lazarus down in Washington. As always, you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.